Good afternoon. So last time we finished up talking about loop and run, and I showed you these performance results from my laptop, and you can see that the number of instructions per element kept going down and down because we had less compares and increments of our loop counter and so on as we did more and more enrolling. And somehow, in spite of this, we had at most, the best performance was one cycle per element. So this is called the latency bound. And we'll talk later today about why does that happen. And you know, this is because the real processors are behaving differently than the ones that you like did in pipe homework. In our pipe homework processor, if you're executing less instructions, the program always takes less time. That's not what's happening here. But first, some logistical talks about what we're going to be doing as far as performance assignments. So we're going to have two labs, which are kind of related to two homeworks we're going to have. So the labs, first one is on loop optimizations, so loop unrolling, and another type of optimization we'll talk about today called multiple accumulators. It's going to be implementing those in assembly. Why assembly? So you know what's actually happening and that the compiler isn't doing something weird behind your back. Next week we'll talk about, in lab, we'll have a lab about vector instructions, which we'll discuss probably on Thursday. Also known as SIMD, which you may remember reading a little sidebar in the textbook about it. So related to these, but not necessarily directly connected to these labs, we have two performance homeworks. And these, unlike every other assignment in this class, you can do with a partner or individually, whatever you like. You can do different things for different ones. First one is to rotate an image. So we'll give you an image as an array of pixels, and we want you to rotate it. Second one is to smooth an image. So we'll give you an image as an array of pixels, and we want you to, in your output, set the output to the average of a little square of pixels. As I said, our image is going to be represented as an array of pixels, so each pixel is going to have a 1 byte red, green, blue, and alpha for transparency value. The reason to have these four components for real is because it turns out that a lot of things work better if the size of a pixel is a power of 2. Not because we think all images should have a transparency component. And the representation of our images is going to be as a flat array. So we'll allocate one big array, and we'll use the dimension, the size of an image, our images will all be square, to say 4 times dimension if our y value is 4 plus 5 if our x value is 5. That's we'll access elements like we've seen with our cache blocking examples. Rather than trying to like set up a multi-dimensional array of varying sizes, which is really, really hard to do in C. And we don't want to have multiple mallocs, that would not be efficient, and we're doing performance assignments, so we definitely care. So rotate, you're going to turn an image like the one on the left to the one on the right, and we supply you this code. So there's something funny going on here with this RIDIX. I'll talk about that in a second. But basically that we're doing assigning to our destination a particular part of our source. And this RIDIX is like x, y, and dimension are the arguments. I'll tell you what that is in a second. So any questions about this basic task? Okay. So RIDIX is a preprocessor macro. So you've probably seen preprocessor macros primarily for doing the boilerplate on headers. They can also have values, and it does a text substitution. So here I have double of x is x times 2. This it gets replaced by double of 100, in this case, 100 times 2. This is really a text substitution. Like really, really, it's not a function call. It really is a text substitution. So for example, I have 3 plus 3 times 2. That expands to 3 plus 3 times 2, which will evaluate to 9, because that's really what happens. Like, we really do that expansion in text, and your compiler compiles it. It doesn't know the macros there. And this is the reason why people don't like these macros. So when you see macros in real software or in what we'll give you, commonly you'll see this pattern where there's these seemingly useless parentheses around every argument to the macro. And that's just so when you do something like this, you get the result you kind of expect if you think it's a function call. And Redux is one of these macros, so it has those extra parentheses to keep bad things from happening. So you don't have to worry that just because this is dim minus one times minus j, that the whole thing gets multiplied by the dimension, not just the j. Okay, so that's about the code in the performance assignment. So the smooth assignment is similar, but it doesn't average. We will supply you code. And your goal is going to be to get a version which on my machine, a testing machine that you will not have direct access to, gives you results a certain amount of times faster. And you're going to be able to submit as many variants as you like within some reasonable limits, like we have to be able to run them in a reasonable amount of time, in one file to Archimedes. And we'll take the best performing one, and that will be what we'll use to determine your grade. When doing this, we suggest like do some optimization, make a new version of the function. Like don't just delete stuff, you can just comment it out or something, but don't just delete stuff that works, because maybe you'll want to go back to it. So we will measure the speed up on my machine, on my desktop, and there will be a web viewer for you to see the results. So you submit something, and sometime later, depending on how many submissions there are, we will run it and we'll show you the results. We'll say it was this many times faster on this size for this version of your function for all of that. So it'll be a web viewer for that, but it won't be instantaneous because you might have to wait in line behind everyone else who submitted something. And the goal is to achieve a certain speed up on my machine. So I've set some thresholds which are listed in the assignments. These are based on, I know if you do certain things that you can meet those thresholds. So the hope is that if you know that everyone will be able to do that because they know the optimizations that make that happen. Since we're running on my machine and not your machine, and my machine has a different microarchitecture than say LabUnix 1, the results you see might be different. Generally, I found that as long as you're using GCC and not Clang to compile things, that you will see the same relative improvement. That if something is much faster on your machine, it will also be much faster in mine. But the amount may vary. Like it might be 3 times faster in your machine, 2 times faster in mine, or the other way around. Small improvements might go either way. The big caveat is if you're using Clang, which you might be doing and not know it, if you're on Mac OS X, which often doesn't have GCC, and there's a program called GCC, but it's really Clang. In that case, the compiler is a different compiler, and it might produce very different code, so you might not get such representative results. But to know the real, know if you're like really done, you need to look at the viewer for results on my machine. So for rotate, we're not going to tell you very much. We tell you how much faster you need to go. We're not going to tell you what optimizations to do. That's part of something you're supposed to figure out. And generally, you should think about the problem and think what techniques seem like they're kind of applicable here. Often there will be some numbers you have to choose. Like if you're doing cache blocking, you need to choose the size of each dimension of the block. If you're doing loop unrolling, you need to decide how many times to unroll the loop. You have these parameters. You should probably try varying numbers just so you make sure that it really doesn't work, not that just that you chose a really poor value. Note that some techniques combine well. For example, loop unrolling and cache blocking combine really well. I'll give an example of that in a second. So you should probably try to take advantage of that. In addition to combining well, note that you might have this phenomenon where, like we saw with when I talked about cache blocking and the arithmetic efficiency, where until you improve the performance of one thing, something else won't help. Like, if your loop is really inefficient, maybe cache optimizations don't help yet, or if you didn't do cache optimizations, maybe loop optimizations won't help yet. So you should not assume just because you tried something earlier before you did other optimizations that it doesn't do anything. It just might be the case that you had a different bottleneck before you fixed, say, bad cache performance. So one thing that I've noticed in the past that people get confused on in this assignment is that they assume that loop unrolling and cache blocking are kind of the same thing. And in particular, they often do something like what's on top here and think that that's just loop unrolling. And it's not, because I'm changing the order in which I access things. In my original loop, if I assume it was kij, just normal loops incrementing by one, I was accessing bij, bij plus one, bij plus two, bij plus three, and so on. In this loop, I'm accessing bij, bij again, then bij plus one, bij plus one again, and so on. I've changed the order I access things, and that's cache blocking. So what I'm doing at the top here is this is cache blocking and loop unrolling. They're great things to do together. Just keep in mind that if you're doing something like this, that is cache blocking and loop unrolling. If you're doing something like on the bottom, that's what just loop unrolling looks like. And the reason why you might care, besides which one is faster, is, well, if the first one is helping you, that tells you, oh, the cache matters here. Maybe I should think about other ways I can make the cache behave better. And if the second one is what's helping you, well, you aren't changing what the cache is doing. It's loop overhead you're dealing with. But in the first one, you're dealing with both loop overhead and cache overhead. And if your first one helps, you might think, maybe there's other things I could do to help of either sort. So any questions about this? So, as I said, there are two performance assignments. For the rotate assignment, we're just not giving you much advice. Part of the assignment is figuring out what to do. For the smooth assignment, we will give you the same sort of grading, which is that there's some thresholds you need to meet, but we're going to tell you, here are some specific optimizations, which when we implement them, get this speed up. And that will be enough to do the assignment. The reason we're doing that for smooth is that the coding for smooth is substantially more difficult than for rotate. In particular, you will need to use SIMD almost certainly to get the performance. It might technically be possible not to, but I don't believe so. To get the speed up you need, you'll need to use SIMD, and we'll have some instructions as to here's a strategy we know works, which you can do, or you can find something else. You can do additional things, but that's the format for the smooth assignment. For rotate, you need to reason about it, figure it out. We've told you about a bunch of optimizations. You should figure out which ones apply. So any questions about the homeworks before I talk about that latency bound again? Okay, so we had this bound of latency here. And I said it was because of how real CPUs work. So let's talk about real CPUs. And we mentioned the two big things that real CPUs do that are different than our pipeline processor. So one thing is they execute multiple instructions at once. They fetch multiple instructions per cycle and try to execute them both at the same time. And basically the idea is we've made multiple copies of the pipeline. Another thing they do is they execute instructions out of order. So just because one instruction is after another in the program doesn't mean that that's how it will be executed. So for example here, while we're executing this slow MR move queue, we're waiting on memory and the processor says, oh, can't do this subtract, oh, but I have this add here. I have everything I need to do the add, I'm just gonna do it. Oh, and I have this XOR here. I have everything I need to do that XOR. I'm just going to do it. The processor just looks for work with whatever values it has available and does whatever it can at any given time without regard to the actual order the program is written. There's some fix-up we have to do in order to actually make sure that it appears the program executes in order. There's some additional work you have to do to handle like branch mispredictions in this case. Branch mispredictions are way more complicated. If I'm choosing an order where I might skip behind and above the branch. So this has a very different kind of CPU design, even though it's still based on pipelining like we've seen before. So a high-level view of what a modern CPU might look like is something like this. So we have our fetch, and we're fetching multiple instructions at once. So we have multiple fetchers, and somehow these deal with branch prediction. I'm not going to explain how we do branch prediction when we're fetching multiple instructions at once, except to say that it's complicated, and one of the reasons we do not have you build one of these processors. But we handle that. Then we decode the instructions, and we put them in what I'm going to call an instruction queue. And this is a list of pending instructions. And we're going to run instructions, any instruction in this list, whenever its operands are available. So this instruction queue is going to track not only what the instructions are, but where their operands are coming from, whether they've been computed yet. And we're going to figure out from that which things to take off this list of instructions and actually run. And this is also where, in this processor design, part of where we're going to handle forwarding. So this is going to handle figuring out where do the values of all the registers come from. So forwarding becomes much more complicated, and that's where we're going to use this list of instructions to help handle that. And whenever we have instructions to run, we have many execution units on which to run the instructions. So for example, we might have a whole bunch of ALUs to do different types of arithmetic instructions. And we have multiple of these because we want to run multiple instructions at once. And sometimes these ALUs and other execution units might have a pipeline themselves. So here we have ALU 1 and 2, which presumably take one cycle, and we have ALU 3, which has two pipeline stages. So you can put in one piece of work every cycle, and we get it out two cycles later. So the instruction queue, as operands are available, puts instructions to do the actual work in these, what we call execution units. And the values eventually flow out of the execution units, when we've finished, into what we call a reorder buffer. So the job of the reorder buffer is we've run these instructions in some random order. It needs to put them back in order and manage making it appear that our program executes one instruction at a time. This is also where we handle things like, what if there's a branch misprediction? We have to find all the instructions before the branch. This is what does that. So the reorder buffer collects the results. It also is responsible for helping send information back to the instruction queue to say, hey, I have these operands available for you. You might be able to start more instructions. So this is sort of a high-level view. Obviously, I'm omitting a bunch of details. And a lot of the things we're doing here, well, you can do them by hand, seem pretty complicated to implement in hardware, because we need to, reason test, here's a list of instructions, which ones can we run? That's not an easy operation to implement in hardware. But this is something that processors since the late 90s, basically all desktop and laptop processors do. They are built with this kind of microarchitecture. So let's talk about what the instruction queue might do. And here I have a hypothetical loop I'm running on my processor. So a first thing to note is that because I have a loop, there's some branches. And I've done branch prediction. So the modern processors do aggressive branch prediction. They do a lot of branch prediction. So we have this conditional jump instruction, but we fetch instructions after it, which we assume is where the branch goes. If we're wrong, when we actually run the conditional jump instruction, we'll find out, half of my instruction queue is useless. That's what we've done. And I've annotated this instruction queue with some extra information. So I have the status of the instruction. So some instructions might be ready to run. These are things that my instruction queue can put onto one of those ALUs or those execution units to actually do the work of the instruction. And I have others where I'm waiting for operands. And in this case, I've listed what instruction they're waiting for. You might imagine this would be one way of implementing an instruction queue so you could easily, when you know an instruction finishes, update the status to know which ones are ready. And what the instruction queue is going to do every single cycle is going to look at all the instructions, find all the ones that are ready, and try to put as many of them as possible on its execution units. And in this example, we have two execution units, two identical execution units. They're both ALUs. We're just ignoring memory instructions for now. And we're going to put as much stuff as we can on that. And when we're starting out, we have one instruction that's ready. We have two ALUs we could run it on. So we're just going to choose one, and sorry, the other ALU, we can't do anything. So it's just going to be sitting there doing nothing. So that's going to run, and it's going to finish. So for the next cycle, we look at our list of instructions, and now this second instruction, which was waiting for one before, now is ready. So we look at all our instructions. We try to put all the ready instructions on ALUs. We have exactly one to put on our two ALUs. So we do that, and next cycle we run instruction two on ALU. And you can see something which is happening here, which is that I have a ton of instructions in my instruction queue, and I can't run most of them. And this kind of phenomenon is why we had that one cycle bound, that latency bound. We'll talk about why it's called a latency bound in a bit. But that's what that was coming from. This sort of thing was happening in our processor. Our processor could have done more work, but we didn't have instructions to put in that place to do work. We couldn't have work to do because of the dependencies, because all the work we could do, we needed values we hadn't computed yet. So as we keep executing this program, when instruction two finishes, instruction three will be ready, and we'll run that. It will be the only thing to run. And then finally, something different happens. Here we have this compare, which depends on instruction three, and this add, which depends on instruction three. And both of them become ready when instruction three finishes. So finally, when we're figuring out what to do in cycle four, we look through this list and we say, oh, we have two things that are ready. Great. That means I can use both of my ALUs. So finally, we get to take advantage of having twice the amount of execution units that our pipeline processor had. So we finished those, run those, and when we finish those, we're going to be able to run this jump and this add here. So in the next cycle, we end up having those two instructions ready, and we're going to end up scheduling instructions 5 and 7 on the ALUs in the next cycle, because that's what was ready when we look to figure out what work do we have to do. So when instruction 7 finishes, we have instruction 8 that depends on it, so we'll end up running that in the next cycle during cycle 6, and keep going. So this is basically what our instruction queues are doing. So we haven't talked about how we implement this, figure out the ready instructions and all that logic. There's some question of how are we sending the operands. But as far as when instructions gets run, this is the logic we use. And you can see that we run into these cases where even though we have plenty of instructions, because we've done branch prediction and we've fetched a whole lot of copies of our loop, we still don't have enough work to do. That because we have this RDX where we keep writing it and reading it, we can't actually do two adds in parallel. So one way of reasoning about this sort of problem is with what we'll call a data flow. So a data flow is a graph where I'm going to draw arrows to represent dependencies between instructions. So our first add instruction here is a dependency of our add instruction number 2, which is a dependency of number 3, which is a dependency of the comp number 4 and the add number 6, and so on. So we just draw all these arrows. And a rule is when we're actually looking at this data flow and figuring out how it gets executed, no matter how clever our instruction queue is, arrows have to go forward in time. We have to execute one instruction after the other if there's an arrow from one to the other. Not at the same time, not before, even though this is an out-of-order processor. And because these arrows go forward in time, another rule we have is that the longest path determines how long we have to wait. We have to finish, to get to this compare number 9, we have to go all the way down each link, and whatever path is longest, we're gonna have to finish each of those steps one after the other. We can't take any shortcuts. So whichever path from one end to the other is longest, that determines how long it takes to execute in the best case. And this is what our book calls the latency bound. And we call it a latency bound because if we want to figure out how long does it take to get from 1 to 9, we're going to say, well, I have to run 1, wait for it to finish, then run 2, wait for it to finish, then run 3, wait for it to finish. So if we want to know the time, we need to add up the latencies. It doesn't matter if we can execute 5 ads per cycle, we can't take advantage of that when we're evaluating this chain of instructions. We need to actually wait for each one to finish. So I mentioned that we have these execution units. So we have these multiple execution units to run instructions. And since we're reasoning about a chain of instructions, we have to think about, well, what kinds of execution units do we have, and how long are they going to take to actually execute some chain of instructions? And there's different types of functional units in processors depending on the kinds of work we're doing. It's not going to be like in our pipeline processor, where we have one ALU, which always takes one cycle. Not all of our instructions are going to fit that model. So one kind of functional unit we might have are, something like an ALU. And sometimes this is not going to take one cycle, and it might be pipelined. So a common thing, for example, is that if we're doing integer multiplication, we might have a pipelined ALU, because it turns out that doing an integer multiplication in one cycle is not actually that easy or efficient. And if we have this, this means that we can input a value every cycle, and then it moves on to the next stage, and we get them out after 3 cycles. So this is a pipeline for doing our ALU operations, and this might be a thing that we'd have in a real processor for a multiply. So given that we have this kind of ALU, let's think about, let's say I'm computing this A times B times C times D with the order of operations I'm showing there. How long is that going to take if this is the ALU I have to compute multiplication? So this ALU, remember, can accept one multiply per cycle. How long is it going to take? So someone want to tell me the answer. Yeah?
9 cycles.
9 cycles. So why 9 cycles?
Because before you can start by doing like the C times D, but you can't do B times that until you finish that.
Yeah. So what's going to happen in time is going to look something like this. We do C times D, then we do B times C times D, and then we do A times that. And we have to actually send the values in each stage. And it could be even worse if it takes me some time to get the value out and put it back in. So indeed, we have 9 cycles to take. And this is not to say that we can't do more multiplications with this ALU. It's just that we can't do these multiplications. We could do independent multiplications in parallel, because it's pipelined, but not these dependent ones. So another kind of functional unit we sometimes have are ones which aren't pipelined. So a common example in real processors is that a divider might work this way. So it turns out implementing division with a pipeline is not actually very efficient or easy. So a typical way a divider will work is that it will have a signal to tell you, am I ready for new inputs? And if it's not, it's working. And it won't accept new inputs, it doesn't have space. So it like does something where it like iterates, subtracting repeatedly, or something like that internally. So when you input a value, it takes a while, and eventually it sets the done signal to true and outputs the value and says it's ready for the next one. And this is a common thing to have with operations like divide. Also, our data cache might look like this. Sometimes our data cache has a miss, so it's going to say, sorry, I can't accept any values, I'm still working on the old ones. And this style of functional unit, unlike our that pipeline ALU, it's going to be the case that, well, even if we have independent divides to do, we can't do it with this. We have to do one divide, then another, just because this doesn't have a pipeline. Okay, and I guess I probably didn't mention it. So the term execution units and functional units are used basically interchangeably. You might see both, they mean the same thing. Probably some people don't like execution units because we're sometimes referring to something which does a load or a store. That's included too. Okay, so we've talked about these execution units and we talked about this data flow model. And we want to apply this data flow model with our knowledge of how long the execution units take to reason about overall performance. So rather than dealing with explicit instructions, I'll sort of abstract that away and just put operations I know are going to use the functional units. And with x86, something to keep in mind is we have some pretty complicated instructions. When we execute them in this processor design, often it turns out we use the execution units multiple times. So in our instruction queue, conceptually, something like an add, which reads from memory at RAX, RBX, 4, might turn into a computation of the address and a load and an add, like three operations. So we care about the fundamental operations, the things the execution units are actually doing, whatever we think those are. So this is what it might be for our loop here. We have our a plus I, we add one, we load that value, and we add it to the sum. And one thing you can observe from this picture of the dependencies and knowing that things go forward in time is that if we're really good at running this on our processor, which has multiple ALUs, can load things at the same time as adding them, that we can do three operations per cycle. That we can add a value to the sum, we can add to help compute an address, and we can load a value. All at the same time. Values for different iterations of the sum, but we can do them all at the same time. And to get our one cycle per element, in fact, we have to be doing this. In fact, are executing multiple things per cycle. We also can look at the longest path. So remember, the rule is the longest path determines how long things will take. We call this the critical path. So we know that when we start with a sum, which is whatever it was in the previous iteration to compute the new sum, we need to do four adds because we have to go through those four adds. So you need to wait to do one add, then the next, then the next. We can't do these adds in any other order because of the dependencies. So if each add takes one cycle, that means that to add these four numbers, we need four cycles, even if we have like 1,000 ALUs in our processor. We still need four cycles. We can't use all of 1,000 ALUs. We're going to look at our instruction queue and say, that's a nice add instruction, but it's not ready. So another thing which this makes more apparent is you saw that when I was doing loop unrolling, I ended up not making, it ended up not improving performance after a while, but it did initially. And you can think of the loop unrolling was eliminating some of these. So every once in a while, we need to check, are we done? We need to look at, you know, where we are in the array and figure out, are we done? And initially, we were doing this every iteration. With loop unrolling, we were doing it every several iterations. And what was happening was that, yes, this is something that is independent and in parallel, but when we were doing it every iteration, it turned out that we ran out of ALUs. But when we were doing it not every iteration, we just had enough ALUs that it stopped mattering, that we had enough parallelism that it didn't slow us down anymore. And that's why we saw that, we go back to these results, that with when we were checking every iteration, well, we ran out of adder. We ran out of compare ALUs to do that because we were doing a comparison. When we reduced the number of comparisons, then we stopped running out of ALUs, so it was faster. But you know, we started encountering the latency bound. We started needing to wait for one ad, then another, even though we had more ALUs free. So this is another case of where we were eliminating one bottleneck only to find another. So by eliminating the bottleneck of not having enough things that can add and compare, by getting rid of comparisons, we ended up not having enough ads that were independent of each other. We had ads which where we needed to wait for one to complete and then the other. So any questions on what happened, on this explanation of what happened when we did loop unrolling and why we got the performance improvements we did and didn't? Okay, so given that we know this model, how do we actually improve this? And to look at that, I'm going to start with a simpler case. So let's say I have a 5-cycle pipelined multiplier. So I put in a value, and after 5 cycles, I get out a new value that is the result of the multiplication. And I can put in one new value every cycle. So, you know, throughput-wise, this multiplier, I can multiply one value every cycle. I can put in new value. Then I start getting values out. So essentially, for your processor, we finish one multiplier every cycle, and that's what matters for how much work can we do. But let's talk about very particular things we want to do. So we have these two orders of operations for multiplying A, B, C, and D. And how long is each going to take given this multiplier? And the hint here is, if you don't know where to start, think about maybe draw the data flow graph. I'll give you a few minutes, a minute or so, and check with neighbors. Okay, if someone want to volunteer an answer to either? Okay.
Yeah, first one's 15 and the other one's 11.
So, okay, so you say the first one is 15 and the other's 11. So I'll start with that. So what was your reasoning for the first one?
So the A times B is going to start off and it's going to take this 5 cycles. It's
Yeah.
And then the multiply by C needs to wait
until that first one's finished. And then only at that point is it able to start taking another five, and then the time state is going to have to wait. And only then is it able to start taking another five.
Yeah, so we have this schedule. We do A times B, then we multiply by C because we can't start it any earlier, even though we could start multiplies earlier, but not that one because we need the result of A times B. So how about for the other part?
And then for the other one, the A times B is going to start, and then on the very next cycle, C times D doesn't have, it's not relying on the result, so it's just able to start, go through. And then that final multiply in the middle is waiting on the result of both of them, so it's going to have to wait until that C times D is finished and then it's able to start.
Yeah. Yeah, so with the other one, and this is subtle. So if you do our analysis of the longest chain, if you do that heuristic, you don't get quite the right answer because you say, okay, this takes five cycles, this takes five cycles, and this is the longest path. So you say it takes 10 cycles. And that would be true if we had an infinite number of multipliers. But we only have one. So the problem is we want to do A times B and C times D at the same time. We could do them at the same time if only we had the hardware. Like the values are available. So instead, we have to do, I probably should draw this bigger. So we have to do, we start A times B, and in the next cycle, we start C times D. So we have four cycles of overlap while they're both working in parallel. And it can't be five just because we only have one multiplier. We had two multipliers, then we'd start them both at the same time and we'd take 10 cycles. But we have one, so one needs to wait. And when both finish, then we can start the final multiply. And because we started the first one late, both are going to finish a cycle, after six cycles. And that's when we're going to have the A times B times C times D happen. And so since here is cycle six, that was cycle five there, this ends up being cycle 11. So questions about this? So you can see that our idea of draw the data flow, look for the longest path, gives us a good idea of the performance, but it's a lower bound. It doesn't take into account that we might have some resource limitations, as happened here. But it's very useful for analysis because in a case where I had more than three multiplies, like I had a loop with like 20 instructions, doing this lower bound analysis sure is way easier than drawing that picture, but for a mix of different kinds of instructions and like five different execution units. And so that's why we teach you about doing this with the data flow. You should be able to also do it in simple cases like this, but when you're really optimizing code, you're just going to probably do the latency bound idea that the book has of saying, let's get a lower bound. How good could it be if we assume we had as much hardware as we needed? Because usually the effect of not having enough is not that big. So questions about this? So this notion that, well, if we have parallel work to do, we get things faster, gives us an idea for how we can rearrange that sum I started with, where it looked like with loop unrolling, I was doing as fast as I could because I had this chain of adds. And the solution there is that we're going to do a sum of the even parts and the odd parts. And if we think about our pipeline processor, this is worse. It's worse because here I'm adding up six values, and to do it, I'm doing seven adds to do that. I'm adding the values to the partial sums, and then I have this extra add at the end. So on my pipeline processor, this is strictly worse. But on our real modern processors, this is going to be better because we've exposed more things to do in parallel. Here we have 6 operations potentially that I can do at the same time. And it turns out that, for example, my laptop can actually do all of these 6 operations. They can start them in the same cycle. It has enough hardware to do that. It can do 2 loads, 2 address computations, and 2 additions of integers all in the same cycle. All starting in the same cycle. And if we look at our latency bound argument, where you said, well, the time that it takes is the longest chain of things is going to be taking 4 adds to do 7, to add up 6 numbers. So we have 7 adds in total, but we have 4 adds of time. Because if we look at the longest chain, we go 1, 2, 3, 4, that's how much time it takes. That's our longest path. And so if each add takes 1 cycle, that means we took 4 cycles to add 6 numbers, which is better than we were doing before, where we had a ratio of 1-to-1. And so what this might look like in C code is this is like sort of the natural equivalent C code, which we would hope would turn into the right assembly. Again, like with loop unrolling, you have to do some little extra work if you have to handle a bit of leftover. But that's usually not a big deal because if we're doing this, presumably our loop has a lot of iterations and is something that's not tiny. And so if we actually do this, so I took my 16 times unrolled loop and I tried it with various numbers of accumulators. So the one line is just normal loop unrolling. Didn't do anything special. 2, I used 2 accumulators, 4, 8, and 16. So we see, as we'd expect, that this stops helping after a certain number of accumulators. And we expect that because, well, we only have so many ALUs. And eventually I'm using all my ALUs. If we look at what the instruction queue is doing, I have like 4 instructions writing and 2 places to put them, which is a better situation than we saw in that example, but that means I can't do any better. But we end up with it getting way worse after a certain point. So what was happening here? What's the problem that I have when I get to this number of accumulators? Yes?
You can't store the accumulators registers.
Yeah, so I have 16 accumulators. There are 16 registers, so seems like a perfect fit, but I also need to store like N and I and A. So I ran out of registers. So with 8 accumulators, my compiler was just adding 2 different registers. With 16 accumulators, my compiler started using the stack. And that meant I had extra cache loads. Yes, they always hit. But this add instruction needs to load a value from cache, add to it, then store it back. That's basically 3 operations instead of 1. And that's where things were slowing down. And since I was already using all the adders available, I couldn't get any faster anyways. So just adding these extra operations could only hurt me. So another thing you might notice here that's weird is my performance topped out at 0.57. What is special about 0.57? And you might say, okay, I have 2 accumulators. I expect that to be twice as fast. But 0.57, where did that come from? And it turns out that this is the limit based on the number of functional units I have. And this doesn't make much sense because it looks like, well, it should kind of be an even number, like either I can do 2 at once or 1 at once. So what's actually happening? Well, we can sort of compute the maximum possible by figuring out what operations we need to do. So we need to do 2 additions per element. So when we have enough accumulators, we don't have to worry about dependencies. So the raw work we need to do is 2 additions per element, 1 to compute the sum, 1 to compute an address. And I also had some loop overhead. And when I looked at the assembly my compiler generated, I had 4 instructions of loop overhead, and that ended up being so 1/4 of an add or compare or branch per element. So for every element, I was doing 1/4 of a compare or branch. And my machine can do 4 adds or branches compares per cycle. We have 4 copies of an ALU that can either do every cycle an add or a compare or evaluate a branch, checking condition codes. And when we add all those together, we take 2 plus the 1/4 for the loop overhead and divide it by 4, we get exactly the attack performance I was getting. So I was getting the maximum my machine's ALUs were capable of, and that was 0.57 because I had to worry about this loop overhead. And that tells you that even though it wasn't helping before, more loop unrolling after I was doing this multiple accumulators might help me. Which is another example of that phenomenon we've seen before, where we have one bottleneck, we fix it, and something else becomes the bottleneck. So previously, doing the additions in parallel was the problem. We couldn't do that because we had the dependencies. And when we fixed that, suddenly our loop overhead mattered again. So any questions about any of these performance numbers? Okay. So I'm going to talk about a couple miscellaneous optimizations, which are useful to know about, but for the most part, things your compiler will do for you that you mostly don't need to do, but I'd like you to know what your compiler does, mostly so you know how to make sure it happens, and so you know what might be happening if you prevented the compiler from doing these optimizations by making your code too complicated in some way. So one thing we've seen a bit before is constant multiplies and divides. So you, when we did the bit fiddling homework, you did 5/8. So this is 5/8 code that's unsigned, which is simpler than what you did. And the compiler, knows that, oh, there's this LEA instruction that can do a multiply by 5. We have a shift instruction that we can use instead of actually using a divide by 8, which just ends up being a lot faster. So what's less obvious is that, this is 5/8. 5 is kind of a special number. It's 1 more than a power of 2. And 8 is a power of 2. But we can do this kind of trick for other values, which is not intuitive at all. So if you compile with some versions of GCC, dividing a function which divides a number by 100, this is the assembly it generates. And what it's doing is it's saying, 1 over 100 is almost this number over 2 to the 37. So it's going to multiply your number by that 1,374,000,000 value, and then divide the result of that multiplication by 2 to the 37 by shifting. And that ends up, believe it or not, executing much faster than using a division instruction. Because the division instruction is surprisingly slow. And your compiler, yes, has the logic to given something to go from 100 to figure out that constant, those constants. And it turns out that not only is it approximately equal, it is close enough to equal that this calculation is exact and always rounds correctly. And the compiler has the logic to figure that out. So this is a neat trick, which you're not going to have to implement yourself. But what you should know about it is that the compiler is not going to do it if you don't have a constant there. If it doesn't know the value is 100 all the time, either because it's literally 100 in your code or it's like a constant x equals 100 you're dividing by, it's not going to do it. It's going to use a divide instruction. It's not going to compute that special value. So any questions about the special cases for dividing. Okay, so another issue that compilers deal with is in loops, we often have to compute addresses in arrays. And intuitively, we often write code which seems like it does something pretty inefficient. So if we take our naive, you know, squaring code, we have all these multiplies by n. And that seems pretty inefficient compared to what we could be doing, and you know, might not be a power of 2. So we're going to do a real multiply. Takes time. Isn't that slow? And there's this transformation we can do where you can observe, oh, you're accessing ak times n plus j, and k is changing by 1 every time. I can just add n each time. And the compiler will often do this transformation for you. It will churn repeated accesses that use an index and need to do a multiplication to compute that index to accesses which use a pointer and add to that pointer based on what you're multiplying by. Which is great for efficiency. We avoid a multiplication in the loop, and you can still write code in your natural way. So the compiler usually does this to eliminate multiplies in your loop. And usually if it's doing so correctly, like if you do it yourself, it's going to be no faster or slower than what the compilers do. But if it doesn't, you might do it yourself and you might get an improvement. So the reason it wouldn't is if your loop is more complicated, the compiler might not figure out, oh, you're accessing the same thing incrementing by n. It won't know that, and it won't generate the right code. But if it can figure it out, it generally does a good job. I'm mentioning this not because we're going to test you on it, but because when you do the performance homeworks, sometimes you run into cases where you make your loop more complicated, and suddenly it's tons slower. And often what's happening is something like this was happening before, and now you made your loop more complicated, and the compiler couldn't figure it out, and it's not happening anymore. And I want you to just have some understanding that that can happen. So another example of a transformation that compilers do is if we have, we're accessing something at various indices, that the compiler can, instead of adding 1 times n each time and 2 times n, it can pre-compute the base addresses, so 1 times n, 2 times n, 3 times n, and add just one constant, in this case, I times n, to handle, say, your unrolled loop. And this can be faster because we're avoiding a bunch of work in the loop. We just add a single constant, which turns out to be the the address computation that our processors really are good at because it comes up all the time with arrays. And that's all we're doing. We aren't adding two values together and then doing that again. So this is something that, for example, GCC will commonly do. But it has kind of a caveat. Let's say our I is plus equals 20. We have 20 of these. And GCC does the transformation work as 20 different variables, different base values that it's using. Well, then this kind of backfires. Because it ends up that we might, the GCC, if it wants to do this transformation, it needs to store the values on the stack. So either it can't do it, or it ends up storing values on the stack. In practice, I've seen it stores some values on the stack. This isn't necessarily inefficient, because we're still avoiding arithmetic, and that might make up for the extra cost of accessing things on the stack. But this is a reason why you can find how I enroll something more and suddenly it becomes way slower, but I'm not doing, they don't have extra accumulators or anything. This is the sort of thing that might be happening. And there's an alternative that could be done. And this I've seen Clang do, and maybe GCC does it sometimes. But there's an alternative where instead we keep a pointer to the base and we observe, oh, these things are apart by n, I can just add the n in the loop. And this is not actually clearly better than the other one because we have more arithmetic instructions in the loop. And we also have more dependencies that if you think about the multiple reason we need multiple accumulators, well, it kind of looks like we might need multiple accumulators for a pointer. Because we have this long dependency chain that we didn't have with GCC's version. So this is another version of the transformation. And as a general rule, usually the compiler will do the right thing, but it might be worth looking at the assembly code or just speculate, or if you have some reason to guess that maybe the addressing is bad, writing it out where you explicitly manipulate pointers in a way you know doesn't do any inefficient computations, doesn't multiply by n, doesn't keep tons of temporary values around, and that might improve performance if the compiler did one of these transformations and didn't work out, or the compiler couldn't figure out your loop to do one of these transformations to get rid of those expensive multiplies and so on. So any questions about these types of transformations? Addressing and loops in general. Yes? So the issue is that it was versus 4 here. So here we have 4. We can fit 4 of these pointers in registers pretty easily. But with 20, obviously, we can't put 20 of them in registers. So they have to go somewhere. And that somewhere is likely the stack. So either the compiler puts them on the stack or doesn't do this transformation. It does the multiplications, neither of which is great. Or it does this version, which might not be as good because now we have to compute each A pointers in order, and then we have this long dependency chain that with here, we can do them all independently. Okay, so something which comes up in the performance assignments is that I always recommend that you look at assembly if you want to know what's going on. I know that almost all of you won't, but I really recommend it. When people optimize things in the real world, they read the compiler output. Because when they don't know what's going on, rather than just say, gosh, that performance is interesting, and what you should be looking for in the compiler output basically is my compiler doing something stupid? Is it putting values on the stack? And if so, you can probably rewrite your code in a way where it's straightforward not to do the stupid thing. So that's my advice on that. Okay, so next we're gonna start talking about vector instructions. We're gonna not finish up this topic. Apparently I went 15 minutes faster than the morning, which is amazing. Okay, talk about vector instructions. And this is a much more impactful optimization than pretty much anything we've seen before. So modern processors have registers that hold a vector, an array of values. So for example, all x86 64 machines have 128-bit registers. And depending on what instructions you're using them with, these might hold 4 ints, or 4 floats, or 2 doubles, or 8 shorts, and so on. And these are named XMM0 through XMM15. And there are some instructions which act on all values in the register, so which treat the register as, say, an array of ints and act on all of the integers in the register all at once. And there are extra copies of the ALU to make these basically as fast as an instruction that works on normal registers. So acting on 4 ints is as fast as acting on 1 int in REX and RBX. And so it's really to your advantage to use these. So these are called vector instructions. They work on vector values. Or SIMD instructions. SIMD stands for single instruction, multiple data. So one instruction operates on multiple values at once. So an example of one of these vector instructions on x86-64 is the PADD, which stands for packed add D word. A D word means double word, which is a 32-bit value in Intel's nomenclature. So this instruction says, I have two registers which have a bunch of 32-bit values, and we're going to add them together. So let's say our two 64-bit registers, so XMM0, when we interpret it as an array of 32-bit values, so it's just 128 bits of data, but if we interpret that as four 32-bit values, it contains 1, 2, 3, 4. When we interpret XMM1 in the same way, we see it contains 5, 6, 7, 8. If we run this instruction, then it's going to set XMM1 to 6, which is 1 plus 5, 8, which is 2 plus 6, 10, which is 3 plus 7, and 12, which is 4 plus 8. So it's going to add all pairs of values all at once. And this is going to take approximately the same amount of time as a normal add instruction acting on, say, REX and RBX would take. But we've done four times the work. And for example, so we have some loop here which does adds two arrays, one array to the other, and this is what it looks like in these vector instructions. So we have a slightly different move instruction. Talk about that. You know, this is basically move, but DQU is the postfix for 128 bits. It stands for double quad word unaligned. And so we move the values into the register, we do this PID, and then we move them back. And yes, I know you expect this to be move DQU. I'm sorry, x86 is not pretty. But that's another 128-bit move instruction. And then we increment our loop index. And here, because we loaded four values, we're incrementing by 16, which is the size of 4 ints. And RAX, in this case, is our offset in bytes into each of the arrays A and B. So I think this is where I'll leave off today. So any questions on this? And this is where we'll pick up, definitely where we'll pick up next time. Yes?
Does it compare to combine this with
that? So the question is, how does this combine with the loop optimizations? So everything we've done with loop optimizations combines with SIMD. So you want to do multiple accumulators where each of the accumulators are these vector registers. You want to do loop unrolling where you're unrolling operations which are, so each iteration of the loop does multiple PIDs. So we're going to want to combine them, and you'd hope that an optimizing compiler would generate these instructions and do it with the loop optimizations. In practice, results vary. And that's what I have for today. So good luck on the lab tomorrow. And see you on Thursday.